logical story, their expectations of the child are refreshingly low. Sit here on the couch with me, sweetheart, and tell me all about your new hamster. Grandparents can reveal secrets about what you were like as a child. Pranks, passions, and near disasters that happened when your dad was 7 years old, just like you are now. And they can spin remarkable tales about life in the olden days when they were growing up. We didn't have computers, there was no internet. We were allowed to run around the neighborhood by ourselves all day. There were no cell phones, and the moms would stand in the street and yell their kid's name when it was time to come home for dinner. There's an extra advantage of children spending time with grandparents. Even kids who adore Nani and Poppy will have a renewed appreciation of their own parents after being away for an afternoon or weekend. You can see it in their happy faces as they ride off on Dad's shoulders, eager though they may be for their next visit to the grandparents. Does it matter if Grandma ignores your rules? While waiting in an airport terminal, I overheard a man talking to a couple who were on their way to babysit their 5-year-old grandchild. It was the first time they'd be caring for the boy over a period of several days. The man said, "It's easy. Here's what you do. The parents are going to hand you a list. Study that list carefully, like it's the Constitution. Nod your head a lot and listen while they go over all the details. Then, the minute they walk out the door, throw the list away and do whatever you want." That's excellent advice. Why? Because children are bilingual. They easily adapt to different rules in different households, just as at school they know how to speak to teachers and interact with other students. Children with divorced parents learn a different set of rules for each home. So if the grandparents don't enforce all the items on your list, it needn't have any effect on the way your children behave with you. Children are usually too smart to say, "Grandma lets me." But if they come home with new demands, you can simply reply, "I know, that sounds like fun, but our rules are different." Of course, there are exceptions. If the grandparents are alcoholics or now married to one, living with an unfenced pool or an unpredictable dog, if grandpa habitually shouts insults at grandma, if they casually disregard your child's legitimate health issues, they can't be permitted to spend unsupervised time with your children. If they're reasonable people who also have a weakness for M&Ms consumed while watching silly television, let it go. Remember, too, that they are a generation older than you and get tired looking after small children for long stretches. That's why they watch so much TV. Dealing with a grandparent's annoying comments. Grandparents' suggestions, corrections, or outright disapproval can be grating, and daughters are particularly sensitive to perceived criticism from their mothers. Instead of allowing yourself to become inflamed by a grandparent's comments, you can learn to manage them. Aim for a vocal style that signals respect, cheerful self-reliance, and non-committal openness to their input. Here's a typical exchange between grandmother and adult daughter with some diplomatic responses. "Jess, I'm worried that by raising Charlotte as a vegetarian, you're making her too finicky. She's going to be rude or wilt from hunger the first time someone offers her a hamburger. Are you sure you want to do that?" Note the irksome rhetorical question structure. "Mom, I can see why you're concerned, but we do expose her to all sorts of different foods. We're not worried about this. Is there anything you've read or heard about kids who are vegetarian becoming lifelong picky eaters?" It's unlikely Grandma will have scientific evidence to back up most of her opinions. Instead, her response may be something along the lines of, anyone can see, or everybody knows, or she may simply shake her head. It's kind to acknowledge her worries without getting into heated debate. She's not going to be raising or ruining any more children of her own. Another approach is to seek her guidance. Do you remember any foods I wanted to eat too much of when I was little or refused to eat at all? How did you handle it? If you were a finicky eater, this might open up a discussion about things your mother did that were ineffective, like forcing you to choke down green vegetables, or your mom might have some enlightening advice about what did work. If she can't recall having to deal with this while raising you, it may put a pause on the conversation while she silently admits to herself that she has no first-hand advice to offer. You and your mom might even detour into some recollections about your childhood dinner table antics or the food she ate when she was a girl. Her fear about your child's diet could be residual anxiety from her own childhood, since issues around eating go back generations in some families. With practice, it's possible to listen to a grandparent's comments without either arguing or caving in. Don't expect to change or educate them, but stay open to the possibility that you might learn from their experience. Let go of old grudges. When you talk to your parent, two conversations are happening at the same time. One is inside your head and arises from childhood memories of your family. On an unconscious level, you may get drawn back to when you were hurt, angry, or felt you were being treated unfairly. Without realizing it, you're still trying to right those wrongs, some of which you may have exaggerated and some that are legitimate. This internal narration affects your external exchanges with your parents, the words you use, the tone, how often you speak, what you refrain from saying. Old grudges become ingrained assumptions. Until you have children, the dysfunction mainly affects you, your parents, and your siblings. But when you become a parent, you have fresh motivation to raise the standard of discourse. Let go of long-held grievances, and you'll be setting a good example for your children. You also have fresh motivation to set boundaries, insist on being treated respectfully, and remove yourself from your parents' company if they refuse to accept their role in past injustices or aren't kind to you, your partner, or your children. Whatever your relationship with your parents, conversing with them in a civilized manner is a deposit on your future. Because the way you speak to your parents is very likely the way your adult kids are going to speak to you. Ongoing friction with your parents affects your ability to be an energetic and nurturing mom or dad. You have a finite amount of emotional fuel. It's depleted or refreshed, depending on your habits of sleep, diet, and exercise, how much you enjoy your daily activities, and the quality of your relationships. Your children are entitled to a generous portion of your energy. If you expend it feeling resentful, stressed, or exploited by a parent's demands, you have little left over for telling bedtime stories or listening to your child describe his best friend's new dog. If you're confused about your feeling toward your mother or father, take this test. When you look at your phone and see that it's your parent calling or texting, what's your first thought? How does your body react? After the call, do you feel lighter and grateful for the companionship? Or do you feel angry, humiliated, weak, or ashamed? If it's the latter, consider making some changes. talk to a therapist, or reduce the tension by setting clear boundaries. Mom, please don't call or text when I'm at work unless it's an emergency. I'm happy to catch up with you over the weekend. In some families, no amount of careful phrasing or modulated vocal tone can improve the tenor of the relationship, and your contact with your parents will have to be more limited. Strings attached. Accepting gifts of time or money from grandparents is not necessarily a problem. Some grandparents pay the children's college tuition because they can afford it, and college has become terribly expensive. Others gladly offer to babysit the grandchildren because they enjoy spending time with them. But in many families, it's more psychologically complex. I have clients who accept money from their parents because they're convinced that education at an elite private school or attendance at costly summer programs are essential preparation for social and academic achievement. I ask these parents, are you selling a part of your soul for this money? Are you giving up your dignity and authority? The grandparents in these families sometimes view the parents as weak or helpless because of their dependency. They have more respect for their grandkids than they do for their own children. This doesn't only take place among wealthy families. The same power plays can develop if the grandparents provide regular child care or allow the kids to stay at their house while the parents go on a vacation, however modest. If you take the phone test and are having negative physical or emotional responses to your parents, the strings are too tight. The other set of grandparents. For most of human history, marriages were arranged. Now that adults in Western countries marry whomever they want, it's frightening for both sets of parents. In what may be a protective instinct for the species, in-laws initially tend to be skeptical of the person their child marries. This can flare up again when a grandchild arrives. To improve and maintain their relationship with the in-laws, I advise parents to think of them as foreign dignitaries. Observe the proper rules of decorum. When you're on their turf, put aside your idiosyncrasies. Room fresheners give me headaches. We don't drink soda. And even your valid complaints. Can't you please turn down the television? When they're at your house, a few gestures in the same vein, such as keeping Diet Coke on hand, will take you far. I learned some splendid in-law tactics from the members of a group of Chinese businesswomen who attended a week-long parenting seminar I taught in Beijing. Many of them lived with a mother-in-law who was helping raise the grandchildren. I asked them to role-play the part of their mother-in-law, and they jumped right in. How can you make my son this breakfast? You know he likes eggs for breakfast. You know how he likes them prepared. He has to work very hard all day, and you're not even trying to pay attention to what he loves. Clearly, the only one who will ever understand him is me. These women were highly accomplished and self-disciplined. They sat in the hotel ballroom for 8 hours a day, never checking their cell phones and rarely taking bathroom breaks out of respect for my time and role as a teacher. They feel the same way about their in-laws. In response to a mother-in-law's criticism about breakfast, they would say something like, "I am so honored to learn from you and find out how to be the best wife to your son." On the page, it sounds subservient, but in person, it was lovely. The Chinese women explain that this is how they disarm their husband's mother and dissipate the tension, which they understand to be caused by the mother-in-law's envy of their youth and opportunities. Many of the mother-in-laws were from farming families and had grown up in rural poverty. In China, the difference between the generations was so stark that it was easy for the younger women to feel generous and compassionate. In Western countries, this type of respectful response to criticism can take the form of a question. Just as when your own mother criticizes your choices, you can deflect your in-laws' judgments by saying in a non-challenging tone, "Tell me what it was like when you were raising John. Did he have chores? Did he ever get punished? If you had it to do over again, would you do anything differently?" Asking these questions gives the elders a chance not only to share their experiences, but also to reflect on their opinions. If you say, "What was it like when my husband was 7 and had to do his homework? How did you encourage him?" they might respond, "Well, they didn't give homework to 7-year-olds back then." Point made. Now they have a little insight into what you're up against. Goodwill for grandparents. With so much attention focused on the children, grandparents sometimes feel taken for granted, or as if they're hired help. Acknowledging grandparents and showing your appreciation fosters goodwill. Send paper birthday cards, not e-cards, and include a warm childhood memory. Now that you're a parent, these memories will more readily spring to mind. The grandparents can reread the card, show it to their friends, and keep it on their nightstand. Ask the grandparent to demonstrate or teach your child a skill. The most obvious example is making a favorite recipe, but your parents possess a lifetime's worth of tricks and talents. Grandpa's technique for knotting his tie or tuning a guitar. Grandma's method of dispensing with spiders or shuffling a deck of cards. When my daughter Emma was in high school, she and her friends drove for 2 hours to have my parents teach them some dance moves. The kids were preparing for a swing dance party and knew where to find the experts. My parents met on a blind date. A mutual friend thought they might be a good match because they were both good dancers. I know Emma appreciates this fun part of her family heritage. Ask the grandchild to record an interview with the grandparent. If Grandma and Grandpa prefer not to be on camera, suggest they speak into a microphone. Most everyone loves reminiscing about his or her life, and unless a grandparent is hobbled by illness, long-term memory stays strong until the end. Grandchildren provide a new audience and no recriminations, so the grandparents may be more willing to open up. Even relatively young children can do these interviews. Look online for lists of questions to get them started. Think of opportunities for the grandparents to be involved, and don't forget Grandpa. Aside from babysitting, what skills do your parents possess that could contribute to the family? Grandfathers cherish the children too, but they often get neglected amid the love fest or ongoing battle between mom and grandma. I've noticed that many grandfathers are far more willing to be involved with their grandkids than they were with their own children. Perhaps a side benefit of waning testosterone levels and competitive drive. And these older men often have good instincts about what will delight a young child. When my daughters were very young, they enjoyed standing on my father's feet as he walked with them, gently singing, "Ba-dum, ba-dum." When he stopped, they would say, "More ba-dum, more ba-dum." Talking to Olivia's mom. Having children is a gateway to new friendships forged at Mommy and Me, on the preschool playground, or during the endurance trials of chaperoning field trips. A few of these will turn into lifelong alliances that outlast the bond between your respective children. Some of the parents will become trusted advisors and reliable fonts of support. Others will generate the kind of self-doubt you haven't felt since middle school. I've listened to moms in session agonize over what to wear and where to sit at the school play, fearing that the popular crowd would not welcome them if they didn't make the right choice. When my daughters were in school, it seemed like every other girl was named Olivia. And Olivia's mom might be overheard saying, "I don't know how Olivia does it. Always up studying when we go to bed. And when we get up in the morning, she's already made breakfast for the whole family and walked the dog." She started a microfund NGO for indigenous women in Colombia, pronounced by Olivia's mom with full Spanish accent. And we think Dartmouth will be recruiting her for diving. Olivia's mom was not exactly lying. Maybe her daughter made breakfast once and walked the dog for a few days and then dropped it. Her family hopes she'll be recruited by a college for diving. If I weren't in the business of hearing the inside stories of so many families, I might have felt disheartened comparing my own daughters to Olivia. Today, far more than in the past, school communities are often the center of parents' social lives. The closeness leads to a heightened sense of both insecurity and competition. Other parents can start to seem like an in-your-face barometer of your parenting skills and social standing. Their children's moment-to-moment successes become the standard by which you judge your own child. My conclusion after many years practicing therapy, people's depictions of their family life are about as authentic as their Facebook page. Until a child enters middle school, it's possible that you'll be interacting with the other parents every day. You may feel the same jitters your child does when you wait at the gate the first day of the year or venture on campus for back-to-school night. Eager to be liked and accepted by the other moms, you may lose perspective about what to say. A good rule of thumb: when getting to know another parent, use the kind of discernment you would with any new acquaintance. If you're eager for instant closeness or popularity, you'll be tempted to reveal too much too soon. Don't sell your child's secrets as the currency of friendship. The test: how would you feel if your child overheard you? We all need friends to help us gauge our child's behavior, but wait and see if this person shows herself worthy of your trust. Do you believe she won't tell her child? Because as soon as she does, your child is likely to find out too. Finally, resist the temptation to bond with other parents by scapegoating or joining in vigilante-style uprisings over the decisions of school administrators, the actions of less-than-perfect teachers, or the influence of a troubled child in the classroom. For a passing thrill, you'll degrade the atmosphere of the school or make another child's life harder. It's not worth it. We need the community of other parents. I tell my patients, find a parent with a child a little bit older than yours, who is turning out pretty well, down to earth, and fairly enthusiastic. When in doubt about a decision regarding your child, ask that parent instead of polling the moms on the playground. Parents who don't become your best friends can still be a valuable source of news and feedback about teachers, coaches, tutors, and other adults who care for your child. The trustees will meet in the next chapter. Chapter 10, The Trustees. Getting the best out of nannies, teachers, coaches, and other adults in your child's life. It takes a village to raise a child, and the other villagers may be thoughtless, delightful, irritating, or inspirational. Some may seem to hold exorbitant power over your child's future. Others are loving allies and mentors. These are the trustees, temporary stewards of your child's mind, emotion, and talents. As your children watch how you interact with these adults or hear you discussing them at home, you are teaching lessons about how to treat authority figures and cope with challenges and honors. In conversations with the trustees, your default assumption should be, "This person wants the best for my child." Your internal mantra, "My child is not a special case." Your approach, attitude, and comments can either put the trustees at ease or cause them to label you difficult. You don't want that label. It's very hard to shed. The nanny, a loving professional. If you have a nanny, your relationship with her or him is a unique one. Just look at the hiring process. No licensed degree or objectively measurable skill set is required of candidates. An agency will conduct a background check. You might get a name from a friend's nanny. You'll call references. But mainly, you grant a stranger full responsibility of your family's most valuable and vulnerable asset based on intuition. And usually, it turns out well. It's obvious that hiring a nanny enables both parents to hold jobs or eliminates the need to commute to and from daycare. But it's the other profound benefits of this role for both child and parents that led me to include nannies among the esteemed trustees. When a nanny enters a child's world, it begins to expand. The unfamiliar becomes accepted and appreciated. New people, other nannies and children at the playground, new foods and flavors, the accent of her speech, her passionate expressions of affection, mi corazón, mi vida, mi amor, new games and songs and knowledge. It's practice for the separation the child will experience and the flexibility he'll need when he enters preschool or kindergarten. Your interaction with the nanny will be your child's first exposure to an employer-employee relationship. It may also be your first experience as a boss. Under your child's curious eye, you'll be negotiating, handling conflict, and issuing instructions, corrections, and praise. Yet this is no ordinary employee, because the nanny is in your home every day, seeing your family in excruciating close-up. And the power balance is a strange one. In many households, both the parents and the nanny feel a little paranoid. The nanny is afraid of angering the parents and getting fired, while the parents are fearful the nanny will lie, steal, or suddenly quit, leaving the child grief-stricken and the parents forced to hastily hire a replacement. Although it's wrenching for children to lose a beloved nanny, if you've fired her with cause, you are actually protecting your child. If she's quit because of changes in her life circumstances, you can invite her to remain connected with your child through visits or holiday and birthday cards. Because this professional relationship is also personal, lines get blurred, usually to the detriment of the nanny. Mothers strain to be nice in an effort to keep the nanny happy, but overly cautious phrasing results in directions the nanny may not understand. Getting too sisterly with the nanny, sharing details about your marriage, health, friends, or work erodes your authority and intrudes on the nanny's privacy, even if it feels like bonding. And telling yourself the nanny is just like a member of the family opens the door to subtle exploitation of her time and love for the child. Set expectations before you hire the nanny. Much of the drama can be avoided if you have the presence of mind to set expectations while you're interviewing the nanny. This isn't as easy as it sounds, because parents can be blinded by relief at ending the search process. A quick emotional connection with the person or a friend's glowing recommendation. Sitting before you is a warm, intelligent, experienced individual available to work right away, and you don't want to put her off by talking about a lot of rules. But contrary to your worries, nannies are reassured by parents who can clearly explain the job. Along with the hours and housing arrangements, if she'll be living with you, you can outline what you expect from her and how you see your own responsibilities. As an employer, fair treatment of a nanny typically includes not asking her to stay late at the last minute, or doing so only in a genuine emergency, paying her overtime, paying her if you'll be away on vacation, telling her in advance when vacations will occur. Instead of reimbursing her, provide a credit card and cash for child-related expenses, arriving on time to relieve her from duty. If you're explicit about rules during the interview, it will be much easier to enforce them when the nanny is working for you. Regarding phone use, you might say, when we're playing with Mila, bathing her, or putting her to bed, we put our phones away and we'll want you to do the same. When you're at the park, we'll expect you to be watching her and not using your phone to play games or check in with friends and family, because an accident can happen in a moment. We'll only text or call you if there's a change of plans or an emergency, and we'll expect the same from you. We don't need you to check in with us about minor decisions. Muy confundido. Several years ago, I led a workshop for nannies in Santa Monica. Most of the women who attended were native Spanish speakers, but all had some English language fluency. My plan was to talk about effective discipline strategies and how to communicate with the children's parents. While the women appreciated the advice about discipline, what they really responded to was the session about talking to moms. Their most frequent complaint, if she had just told me how she wanted it done, or what she wanted me to do, I would have been glad to comply. I heard lots of confundido and frustrado, confused and frustrated. In her book, Secrets of the Nanny Whisperer, Tammy Gold addresses the mix-ups that most often provoke nannies. In adapted form, here are her 6 rules for better communication. 1. Never pose a direction as a question. Not, do you think you could change the sheets today, but please change the sheets today. 2. Never use the word if. If you get a chance, could you, makes the request seem optional and low priority. 3. When you want the nanny to do something, tell her directly. Women have a communication habit of couching their wishes in suggestions. Think of all the times your mother said, doesn't it seem cold to be leaving the house without a jacket? Don't ask or hint, just say it. Please make 3 sandwiches to bring to the park so Sammy will have some to share with his friends. 4. Don't attribute your needs or requests to someone or something else. Parents sometimes do this in an attempt to add weight to their directives, but it can backfire. Telling the nanny that a new study says babies should stop using pacifiers by 12 months can be perceived as information, not an instruction. The nanny may think, "I've been taking care of kids for 20 years, and it hasn't hurt any of them." Own your decision. We're weaning Cora from the pacifier. Please don't let her use it. Thanks. 5. Don't give frequent feedback or directions in email or texts. Resist interrupting your nanny's time with your child or her time off. Short messages about schedule changes are essential. But despite the efficiency of instant communication, don't deliver negative feedback or complicated instructions over a device. It's too easily ignored or misunderstood, especially by nannies for whom English is a second language. 6. Your nanny is not a mind reader. Even if you think the nanny knows your values and routines, tell her out loud exactly what you want her to do or not to do. This is true for all nannies, but particularly those raised in environments where the cultural norms may be different from yours. Don't assume the nanny knows what you mean, what you intend, or what you would prefer. The weekly check-in. I advise all parents with nannies to schedule a brief weekly check-in. It doesn't have to be on Friday afternoon, but it should be a meeting you observe religiously. As much as any other strategy, this will keep the parent-nanny relationship low stress and also alert you to problems, both by listening to what the nanny tells you and noticing what she doesn't say. Nannies are prone to downplaying concerns or not mentioning them at all. You'll have to earn her trust over time by reacting calmly and not switching into prosecution mode when she gives you less than rosy feedback, as you'll also learn to do with an older child's teacher. The weekly meeting is how you'll get a sense of the relationship between the nanny and your child. It's not reflected in the number of concerns she reports, but in the details she shares about the child. The meeting can begin with you asking, "How did the week go? Is there anything I should know? Anything unusual you've seen in Derek's behavior?" Maybe she'll grin and say, "He's starting to be very careful about how he parts his hair, and he's looking at himself in the mirror a lot. He says he has a crush on Kylie." A loving, astute, fresh observation is a sign she's attuned to your little one and not on Facebook or texting her friends. Vague, phoning it in answers signal the opposite. If you're not getting any stories like that from the nanny and she appears preoccupied with personal problems, you can say, "You've seemed a little worried lately. Is it something you'd feel comfortable telling me about?" If she insists everything is fine and you're still uneasy, investigate. Come home unexpectedly. Have a friend drop by unannounced. Or show up at the park. "I got off work early." Don't ignore your gut feelings. Your children will probably behave better with the nanny than with you. That can be confusing, leading you to fret that they love the nanny more than their own mom or dad. But this is the same principle you'll see when they come home from school in a gloomy, babyish, or hostile mood. Their day is long and demanding, and they act the worst with the people they love the most. If your child loves the nanny too, you've succeeded. Mastering the triad of nanny, parent, and child is excellent preparation for the bonds you'll soon be forging with your child's teachers. Teachers on trial. When most of us were growing up, our parents didn't fret much about whether our teachers were fair-minded and inspiring. They also didn't fetishize grades. Mom and Dad's loyalties were clear: obey the adults. If we were sent to the principal's office, our parents' ire would be aimed directly at us. We could insist that it wasn't fair, that we had a side of the story too, but even if they listened to us, most parents didn't take it upon themselves to plead our case. Their response was usually, "That may be, but I've got news for you. Life's not fair. Get your act together." Not anymore. The venerable alliance between teachers and parents has ruptured, and today many parents reflexively side with their children in classroom disputes. They play puppet master, calling or emailing teachers to badger them, often in the politest of tones, into providing a second chance, a more flexible interpretation of the rules, a "but he was provoked" or "he'll never do it again" pass for their child. It's the dark side of devotion, and it can backfire in ways parents don't intend. We know that when children are protected from the consequences of not turning in work on time, playing video games instead of studying, or breaking rules, they acquire a photoshopped view of life that makes the adult world harder to master. Why, then, are parents so intent on running interference for their children? The same forces we've been discussing throughout the book are in stark relief at school. Parents see a pristine report card or transcript as a passport, vital fortification against an uncertain future. Their child's social transgressions, innocent missteps unlikely to be repeated. Accolades and triumphs, validation of the parent's worth. With so much at stake, parents' emotions overtake their common sense. In this charged atmosphere, teachers are no longer viewed as colorful supporting players in the saga of a child's life, but as agents of good or evil. They're scrutinized, kissed up to, gossiped about, lobbied against. Rarely is today's teacher left to do her job with a sensible measure of hands-off parental trust and support. Educators in private schools and in high tax bracket public districts contend with parents who believe that their dollars buy them round-the-clock access to the faculty. Teachers in underprivileged neighborhoods have a different challenge. Parents may be hesitant to engage due to lack of English language fluency or their own negative experiences in a classroom. They may be weary from juggling multiple jobs or unaware of the benefits of showing up for parent-teacher conferences. In these cases, the parents don't interfere, but their lack of involvement leaves teachers without the kind of connection that can support student learning. Teachers find themselves at either extreme, fending off helicopter parents or fending for themselves. Helicopter or snowplow or kamikaze parenting has been on the rise for about 20 years, long enough to have had a permanent impact on teachers' classroom approach. Some of this is positive. Administrators and teachers have become more alert to signs of learning disabilities, more aware of the long-term effects of bullying, more respectful of gender orientation, ethnic and social class diversity, and the strain of prejudice. There were drawbacks to the day when parents automatically sided with the school without thoughtful regard for a child's heartfelt complaints or legitimate learning struggles. But in the course of this sea change, teachers and parents have become warier of each other. As parents have stepped in, some teachers have stepped back. They've reconsidered what they're willing to say to a parent or recommend for a student. Paradoxically, the more a parent pressures a teacher, the less likely the child is to benefit from the best that teacher has to offer. The most glaring and widespread example of this is grade inflation and its byproduct, candor deflation. I titled my last book, The Blessing of a B-, because so many parents react to a B- by panicking, hiring tutors, and pestering or petitioning the teacher. With parents in such a tizzy, the grading scale has become distorted. A capable but uncommitted student who doesn't reliably participate in class, hand in homework on time, or prepare for tests won't get a D or usually even a C. It's not worth it to the teacher to ruffle the parents, who may complain to the administration that their child isn't thriving because of the quality of the instruction. Not only are teachers using a vanity grading scale, they've also become hesitant to offer frank assessments when they see children squandering their gifts or casually giving up on tasks that don't come easily. The teachers don't lie, but many have learned to be less than forthcoming because they've experienced the consequences. The result is that parents are deprived of useful information about their child. Stealth tutoring, parental rewrites, and other signposts on the road to perdition. You cannot airlift kids to the summit, plant the flag in their hands, and call it their accomplishment. Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of How to Raise an Adult. At its most damaging, parental interference crosses the line into dishonesty. In many of the families I counsel, the children have tutors in one or more subjects as a kind of grade insurance. Some are stealth tutors, meaning the children are cued not to let the teacher know they're getting extra instruction. Asking children to keep secrets from their teachers sends a confusing message. It's okay to lie to an adult when it buys you an advantage over your peers. It's also an example of how the rules don't apply equally to everyone. This secret is an unfair and demoralizing burden to place on any child. Another area where the ethical lines get fuzzy is homework. When I meet with teacher groups, I always advise them to inform parents at the beginning of the year about how involved they want them to be in everyday assignments or special projects. If your child's teacher doesn't give you guidelines at back-to-school night or in a welcome to fourth grade blog post or newsletter, ask her directly. When the expectations are unclear, it's easy for well-meaning parents to give too much help, especially since the amount of homework, sports practice, and other extracurriculars has gotten out of hand at so many schools. The problem only increases as the child gets older and community service obligations, rehearsals, and sports team travels fill their calendars. Now mom or dad rewrites a paper out of sympathy mixed with ambition and again hints that what happens at home should stay at home. The child shouldn't tell the teacher. Then there's a test on the material and the child bombs it. The teacher's got the paper and the test in front of her and calls the parents. The parents can be candid or they can improvise an excuse. Oh, right, she was coming down with the flu the day of the test. That's why she wasn't able to concentrate. Why not let her retake it next week? If there's a pattern of deception, no one is fooled, and the teacher is going to write off that family, not the student, the family. Faculty and administrators are aware of the stresses some of their most privileged, on the surface, students face. The parents are always traveling or working. Mom or dad is depressed, an addict, or ready to separate. There are money problems. The child is feeling lost or neglected in a blended family. The teacher knows they can offer the student precious attention and care, and of course, they want to be a nurturing presence in the child's life. Teachers don't blame children for their parents' behavior. However, if they sense that their recommendations are being met with superficial compliance but deep resistance and lack of follow-through, or that the parent is continuing to lie or cover up for the student, many teachers will pull back on their efforts with the family. That usually amounts to being less scrupulous about transmitting information and less creative about finding solutions to the child's academic struggles. At public schools, the same problems exist, but the teachers often have a greater number of pupils per classroom and little patience for tiptoeing around parental shenanigans. They may shrug and let it go, bad for the child who concludes that cheating works because teachers are dumb, don't care, or both. But it's just as likely that the teacher will pull the student aside and demand to know what's going on, forcing the child into a humiliating confession or a lie. She may even call the family in for a meeting with the principal, where the parents will be questioned and the student further embarrassed or disciplined. For too many families, the bad habits continue when the student is in college. The parental edits, where the paper is essentially rewritten, the excuses, the cover-ups, have by then become absorbed into the child's ethical framework. It's okay to cheat. Just don't get caught. Everyone does it. Unintended consequences of stealth tutoring and parental deception include loss of intrinsic motivation. I'm doing this work for my parents and teachers, not for myself. Loss of gratification and pride, the kind that comes from figuring out how to meet learning and creative challenges on your own. Lowered self-confidence. I must be pretty defective if my parents have to hire a high-priced specialist to come to our house or lie to my teachers to make excuses for me. Unwittingly teaching children that problems can be solved quickly and neatly by spending money. Good parents make bad choices because they want reality to be different from what it is. I tell them, please don't deprive your child of reality. It's a wonderful teacher and it's free. You don't have to pay any tuition for reality. You have to pay a lot of money to protect your child from reality. How to talk to the teacher at parent conference or anywhere else. Your goal in talking to your child's teacher is to create a spirit of partnership. You want her to be candid. You want to reinforce what she's trying to accomplish in the classroom through your actions at home. In order to give her the confidence to be honest, you need to communicate that you can take it. If you really want to gain her trust, you may need to confide that your reflex response to unfavorable feedback is panic or denial. Any mother can say this because it's true enough. Then tell her how much you value her opinions and want her to feel free to share them. Your words and demeanor should express humility and emphasize your amateur status. This isn't kissing up to the teacher. It's acknowledging her expertise in an arena about which you have little knowledge, even if you've read a lot of books. If you're a child development professional, it's still true that you don't teach at your child's school, and even if you do, you aren't privy to the dynamics of your child's particular classroom. There are two reasons it's important to explicitly communicate respect and openness right at the start. The first is most parents' tendency to side with their child. The teacher is battle-weary and will assume that's your stance too, unless you assure her that it's not. The second reason is that the teacher might be intimidated by you. If your child goes to a private school, it's likely that your family income and social status are more elevated than hers. In private schools and public schools in high-tax bracket districts, you can distinguish the teacher parking lot from the one reserved for the students in an instant. The lot with the newer, more expensive models? Students. You can level the playing field by talking about what you don't have. Her knowledge of children. It only takes one thoughtful remark, such as, "It's so good to be here. Second grade is new territory for us, and I want to learn how we can help Gabe meet your goals for him and for the class in general." At back-to-school night, most teachers will describe the normal developmental milestones and typical behavior of boys and girls at this grade level, social issues that typically arise, and subjects with which students commonly struggle. Unless you have a terrific memory, take notes so you can refer to what she said when you meet one-on-one. Your first opportunity will probably be at the parent-teacher conference. These meetings are usually brief, between 12 and 20 minutes, so come prepared. If a progress report has already been sent out, bring it along so you can refer to it. If you are unsure how you can best help your child with any problems he may be having, ask the teacher for clarification. If your child is or will be facing emotional challenges, let the teacher know. Without oversharing, put frankness before personal privacy or embarrassment. Tell the teacher you'd be grateful if she would alert you to any changes she sees in your child's behavior or mood. This provides her with more evidence of your "I can take it" attitude. Common issues that affect children's behavior include parents who are separating, a parent who is ill, a sibling who is having a problem, a new baby on the way, or a beloved nanny who is leaving the family. Tell the teacher if your child has a previously diagnosed emotional or learning issue. "I know you may not want to do this." We want to protect him from negative expectations or labeling. A new teacher and classroom offers us an opportunity to test out whether the problem was environmentally induced. But by not alerting the teacher to these challenges, you're violating the spirit of an open partnership and depriving your child of her sensitivity and expertise. Some schools have adopted a model of parent-teacher conferences that includes the student. There are benefits to everyone hearing the same feedback and joining together to appreciate a child's growth. Parents tend to remember any reported weaknesses better than even a long and enthusiastic list of his strengths. If a child is going through a rough patch, it can help to have everyone put their heads together to set goals. But some topics are best explored initially without the student present. For example, concerns about your child's mental health or possible learning disorders. After the conference, contact the teacher to ask for an additional appointment and inquire whether she feels it would be useful for the school counselor to observe your child in the classroom and on the play yard before your next meeting. Taking teacher relations up a notch. During the parent-teacher conference, you'll want to stress your support for the teacher and avoid words or deeds that will cause her to feel defensive. Within this framework, you can still voice concerns, and the teacher will be more open to them because you've shown that you respect her work and commitment. To that end, know your occupational hazard. A parent who was an FBI agent told me, "My job is to look for clues and figure out who the perp is, so it's hard for me as a mother because I'm always assuming my daughter is hiding something." Parents do the same thing with teachers and other trustees. The attorney moms will cross-examine the teacher. The therapist's father will psychoanalyze her. Marketing managers try to flatter and seduce. CEOs try to intimidate. We all have occupational hazards.